Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, to start us off, Andrea Cunliffe speaks with Mark Dunley about Texas and the power grid. Could what happened there ever happen here? Then we begin a five-part series on Malcolm X, with the anniversary of his death coming up this weekend. Brother X talks to us about Malcolm's views, thoughts, and how they apply to today's freedom struggles. After that, February is National Teen Dating Violence Awareness and Prevention Month. Sarah McGonia gives us a better understanding of teen dating violence, followed by an interview with Avery Stemple about his new business, Caller City Mushrooms, which opened for business on February 6th. And finally, we finish our three-part interview with Casey Camp Horonek and hear about how the Ponca tribe has been impacted by coronavirus. But first, here are the headlines. The Times Union reports that while the Democrats in the state legislature have increasingly discussed curbing the executive powers they granted Governor Cuomo to deal with COVID, they have failed to come to an agreement. The latest proposal by the Senate Democrats is to establish a 10-person bipartisan commission that would end Cuomo's ability to issue unilateral directives without approval by the panel. The Times Union reported that the FBI has launched an investigation with the United States Attorney's Office in Brooklyn into Cuomo's handling of nursing homes during the pandemic. Meanwhile, in less than startling news, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio joined a number of other elected officials to say that he has received a bullying phone call from the governor. Vaccine providers across the capital region and state were awaiting word Thursday on when delayed shipments of COVID-19 vaccine would arrive after storms in the south caused distribution hubs to temporarily close and vaccination clinics to be postponed. Employees from the Schenectady Center for Rehabilitation and Nursing joined hundreds of other nursing home workers statewide in picketing outside their facilities Thursday to advocate for increased investment in resident care and staffing. Times Union reports that SEIU last week launched a multi-million dollar ad campaign calling for systemic reform in nursing homes after a recent state attorney general's report exposed concerns nursing home residents have had for years about low staffing levels in New York. And the Gazette reports that about 40 landlords picketed at the state capitol on Thursday to draw attention to the economic impact of the tenant eviction moratorium put in place by Cuomo on March 20th and extended until at least May 1st of this year. The eviction moratorium applies to all tenants without respect to employment or income status. A separate state law protects tenants from eviction until the end of the year if they face financial hardship due to COVID. A similar protest took place at the mayor's home in New York City. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's at mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390. That's 518-272-2390. Texas experienced a major loss of power and water during President's Week because the brutal cold overwhelmed their fossil fuel system. Though GOP leaders in the state tried to blame it on wind and the Green New Deal, HMM's Andrea Cunliffe talks about the causes of the Texas crisis with Mark Dunley, co-chair of the Eco Action Committee of the Green Party of the U.S.
Hello, this is Andrea Cunliffe from the Sanctuary for Independent Media's Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm speaking this afternoon with Mark Dunley, who is a co-chair of the Eco Action Committee for the Green Party of the United States. Well, Mark, earlier this week, a harsh winter storm knocked out the power to 4 million people in Texas. Now, you know, they say that many people are back turned on again. They have their electricity on. But there's a few, I'm sure it's also mentioned, there's quite a few that aren't turned on. So, Mark, how did this happen in Texas?
Well, certainly the situation that kicked it off was the extremely cold temperatures. And many would point that as to manifestation of climate change as the Arctic heats up and the poles and the equators heat up much faster under climate change than the rest of the planet. And the very warm temperatures we've been seeing in the Arctic help push the polar vortex, down into Texas and central United States. And so they were seeing, temperatures, I guess some in the 0 degrees, but certainly well below zero. But it, primarily it was the fossil fuels that froze up. They didn't winterize. And so the valves, didn't function properly. The water to do the cooling at the nuclear power plants froze. So between the oil and the coal and the nukes, and particularly natural gas, that was probably about 87% of the problem. And there was some problem with the wind turbines, but the firm that actually manages the energy grid for Texas said that the renewable energy came on much faster back onto the grid than and the fossil fuels. And it's clear it was the fossil fuels that created this problem, despite the efforts by Republican leaders in Texas to blame it on renewable energy.
Now, that's the question I have is that here we are. How they weren't informed that there was a weather storm coming towards them, and nobody decided to put antifreeze in the equipment or whatever one needs to do to winterize it?
I mean, they should winterize on an annual basis, but yes, they should be monitoring the weather more closely. But this is not a unique occurrence. And reality is just 10 years ago, they had a similar massive blackout. And the Texas Senate, which investigated the energy crisis back in 2011, concluded that the companies, fossil fuel companies, needed to winterize in order to avoid such a catastrophe occurring again. And they did not. And in fact, another blackout or another crisis that occurred 20 years previously. So this is not like once, in a 100-year situation. This is a situation that's been occurring now once every 10 years. And with climate change causes extreme weather at both ends of the dial. So both cold weather and warm weather to move, further outside the normal parameters. So this is not the last time that Texas and other parts of the country are going to see, such severe winter conditions.
Well, there was so much publicity about it, so many news reports about it. And the government or the governor, I believe, someone was stating that it was something to do with wind turbines or the environmentally sound.
Actually, Texas does lead the country in wind production. About 17%, I believe, of the state's electricity comes from wind, but that, as I said, that leaves more than 80% coming from fossil fuels. And yes, some of the wind turbines did freeze up, but the reality is other countries and states like Alaska and Sweden, which have colder temperatures on a regular basis than what Texas experienced, their wind turbines operate fine, and that is because they prepare them for a relatively nominal cost to deal with extreme weather with the very frigid temperatures. Texas did not. And one of the problems with Texas is that it is not connected to the rest of the national electric grid. It's the only state in the country like that. And
now, why is that? Why are they the only state not connected? And
well, this goes back a long time. I believe it's about 1935. But in general, they decided not to connect because they didn't want to be subject to federal regulation. They wanted to be good old Texas oil tycoons and more wheel and deal. And that sort of leads to two problems. One is you don't have a central authority that, as in the other 49 states, will say you need to prepare for extreme weather situations and you need to have a certain amount of excess capacity in your system to deal with that. You don't have that safety margin and Texas. And then also because Texas doesn't connect to the rest of the nation's electric system because it wants to avoid federal regulation, it means that unlike other states, it was not able to import electricity in when they had emergency. Now, to be honest, a lot of the other where they could tap into themselves were experiencing energy shortfalls because of the extreme weather. So, you know, it isn't clear how much electricity they might have been able to import at the present time. If we had a stronger national grid, they would be. The United States has the weakest grid among all the industrial countries. But some of the cities that are on the border of Texas, like El Paso, they've decided to opt out of the Texas system. And so they did not experience the type of electric collapse that the rest of Texas did, because they were able to go into the grid and buy electricity from other states. There was some electricity that was available for Texas to buy, but the cost was so high that they decided better to do these rolling blackouts.
Well, what's happening now is that the federal government's coming in to be of assistance to the state in many ways. And since the grid is its own independent grid, are we now, the federal government, going to help to repair that grid? Or maybe we should look at what infrastructure they have and maybe rebuild some of this as renewable energies supply rather than...
They are actually seen as having a fairly good production system. Their problem was they did not have the coordination, the planning, both to deal with the situation, but also for, you know, somebody to say, listen, you need to create more of a safety margin. I read that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency that controls the nation's energy system, you know, is saying that it may be time for Texas to be required to rejoin the rest of the country, that particularly as we move to a new energy system more based on renewable energy, we need to ensure that there's more control. And then interestingly, as I pointed out, that Texas is the largest producer of wind electricity in the country. And because they're not connected to the rest of the country in the grid, these wind producers are not able to sell their excess electricity into the national grid. And in fact, there are moments in time when the Texas wind turbines actually give away their electricity for free because they still, for some reason, are entitled to various federal tax credits. So even if they give it away for free with the federal tax credits, they're making money. But the wind companies may really want now to push to connect to the rest of the country's electric grid so they can sell their excess wind production, you know, into the grid.
Yeah, I know. So I just wanted to say, is this related to climate change, or is there something further you'd like to add to this?
Well, it definitely does relate to the climate change. This, you know, we talk about global warming, but the reality is we're pushing the climate outside its normal parameters. So it's not only extreme heat we'll be seeing, but also when it's cold, you'll see extreme cold. You'll see extreme snowfalls and northeasters occurring, you know, during the winter system. So this type of thing is going to occur more and more often.
A collapse is unlikely to occur in New York. One is that we do prepare more for winter weather. We also have a central planning authority, which requires more excess capacity to be built in. Third, because we are part of the national electric grid, we can buy electricity from other states in emergency situations more easily than Texas.
Andrea Cunliffe, I want to thank you today for the Sanctuary. And I've been Mark Dunley from the Eco Action Committee of the Green Party of the United States. Check us out on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was HMM's Andrea Cunliffe speaking with Mark Dunley, co-chair of the Eco Action Committee of the Green Party of the United States. On February 21st, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, New York, African-American revolutionary activist Malcolm X was assassinated while addressing a meeting of his group, the Organization of African-American Unity. Malcolm X was a prominent figure in the Black freedom struggle. WOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviewed activist organizer Brother X of the Capital Region in a five-part segment about Malcolm's views and thoughts and how they apply to today's freedom struggles. This is part one.
Yeah, good evening. This is Willie Terry, WOOC roaming labor correspondent. February is known as Black History Month, but it's also known for the day, February the 21st, when one of our greatest Black revolutionary and historical figures was assassinated, Malcolm X, in Harlem. Malcolm and his thoughts influenced millions of people worldwide, still doing today. And today, it is my honor to interview a person who Malcolm had influence on. And he go by the name of Brother X. Hello, Brother X. How you doing?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you?
All right. But, Brother X, before I get into the interview about Malcolm, could you tell us a little bit about your life here in the Capital Region?
Certainly. I was born here in 1982, July 5th. Mm-hmm. I moved around quite a bit as a young person. Moving from Latham to Del Mar and eventually to Clemburn in Maryland. I was an athlete. Played a little basketball, won a scholarship. Finished my education in West Virginia, Shepherd College, Shepherd University now. After that, I moved back here, and I've been here ever since. I'm going to say from 2005 or late 2004 to now. And only got to be an organizer, I want to say, about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So did you have an aspiration? I mean, you say you played basketball and got a scholarship. Did you have an aspiration to go to the NBA or something?
Yeah. Society, black youths are positioned or maneuvered to want to attain monetary resources or jobs through the NBA, the NFL, other sporting outlets. And so just like most black youths in ghettos, a ball was put in my hands the moment I came out the womb. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a family background of athletics, and that, you know, pretty much consumed me. And so it became the only talent I had. So, yeah, certainly I wanted to be a professional basketball player. But unfortunately, I was too small. I was tall enough, but I wasn't big enough. So that nixed that particular dream.
Right. I hear you. But so how did you arrive at your name, calling yourself Brother X?
Well, upon being awakened, and we call it in the conscious community, opening your third eye, it wasn't anything in regards to particular movies. Actually, a brother by the name of Dr. Umar Johnson, whom I was coming across some of his videos and things on Facebook and YouTube, and Mike Brown Jr. had just been killed. And so I wanted answers, and the brother seemed to be breaking things down in a way that never had been explained to me. Black youths, one thing that is kept from them is the state of black society in America and the true goings on of why we're in predicament, why we act the way we do, so on and so forth. And he put it together so articulately that it kind of broke me down. And then as I listened further to him, it built me back up. And so I felt that I had a new beginning, a new life. I became a new person. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I started mirroring Minister Malcolm X. And the minister, I haven't heard him before, and I watched his movies, and I watched the movies before because I loved Denzel Washington. So I loved Denzel's depiction of Malcolm X. He looked passingly like him. So I could watch the movies and just enjoy his dialogue and the positions he had, the power he showed within the movie. Once I became conscious, I could see the real truth that he was saying, that it wasn't a script, it actually was a reality. And Malcolm, I like to call my spiritual ancestral father. And so instead of, because I have another name around here too, Kobe, after the since passed athletic superstar, Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to give, especially black youth and other black people, you know, the question. Malcolm X said he kept the name X so that when people would ask him about the X, he could explain what the X meant, that our people were brought here in chains, and that we were given the names of our slave masters, and the names that we had previous to would never be found again. So that was a lesson he liked to give. And so that's the reason why I wanted to become Brother X, as you put it.
Yeah, he did talk about the naming of black people a lot in some of his speeches. So so you have read a lot about Malcolm, I guess, and What are some other ways he influenced you?
Well, just my political perspective, everything about Malcolm. And obviously, you know, you have agreements and disagreements, but what I found about him was that he was such a strong man, and then we actually mirror each other in height and almost size. I'm a lot heavier than him now, but during the time that I became really aware of him and his teaching, we're about the same size. I'm just a lot darker. But he had aspirations of wanting to be darker as well, because his father was a very dark man, and, you know, he's very fair-skinned. But just the overall political philosophy of Malcolm and his love of his people influenced me greatly. And the importance of organizing locally, that he's known as an international figure. But what people don't know is that before he died and after he was scheduled to go to China, I believe, to speak at a revolutionary convention, he was going to spend the next 6 and 7 months building up his local organization, the OAAU. Mm-hmm. And he was just going to get on the ground, knock on people's doors. And you have a figure, an international figure, who's on every TV show that you can imagine during that time. And imagine at that time, there was only a few TV shows at that time for people who had televisions. So now you have a man who's on television with some of the most influential white media, mainstream media outlets and personalities. Now he's knocking at your door talking to you about getting involved in the struggle. And so, you know, to continue that work, to be involved in knocking on doors that many activists have done, but to really have a real politically astute discussion about where our people are and where we should head, he wanted to do that. And then, you know, after all the glitz and glamour of Malcolm that they made, that influenced me the most.
Right. Okay. Now, I know that when you study Malcolm, you know, Malcolm, he was very analytical. And now, looking at the state of black people today, you know, let's say in the capital region, how would you characterize this weekend the commemoration of Malcolm X in terms of what's going on with black people here in the capital region?
Well, unfortunately, in Black History Month and having the society name the month that which you're supposed to celebrate yourself, that means they have total control. And so every weekend in February, they made sure that there was some type of distraction that was a black essence, but not a liberational spiritual essence. For instance, they have the Super Bowl, and then they have different movie celebrations and music awards that our people can't wait to see. And so if we're looking, it's more of a distraction. If we're looking at that to be more entertaining, because the dominant society makes it that our number one purpose in life is to be entertained and entertain other people. So when you mention a Malcolm X and that this was the time he was assassinated, year by year, our people are forgetting. Especially here, there's no real celebration or recognition of Malcolm X. Our group was one of the only groups that really put that out there in terms of his birthday and him having been here quite a few times. Malcolm did a lot of organizing in Albany, and there's no real presence of it because he was aware of the decadence politically of Albany. And Malcolm was not a fearful man. He was a courageous man. So he would go to the very areas that were most troubling for our people. We spent a lot of time here. And unfortunately, there's no remnants of that. You have to kind of ask people, and maybe they'll have some recollection of him. He have his bloodline here, and certainly I've reached out to them. But other than that, there's not going to be a mainstream connection with Malcolm and our people. And because there's no mainstream connection, then our people will deem it something that is not important. You know, when you're dealing with the grassroots, you're dealing with sovereignty, you're dealing with independence, you're dealing with, hey, we are in control of what we believe in, what we say is important. But when you are a controlled people, when you're a sheepish people, when you're in love with the very people who have captured you, you only believe what they say, and you only celebrate what they say you should celebrate. And so I'm not surprised that Malcolm is not heralded here at least 2 times a year, obviously February 21st and then May 19th, his birth. because my wife and I went to something that was supposed to be for Malcolm, and we were appalled in the way that it was done. It was done by people who philosophically disagreed with Malcolm in every bit of his understanding and his belief system. So there was no reason for them to have anything for Malcolm. As a matter of fact, the people that were panel discussionists had never heard Malcolm speak. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at a sabotaging of a legacy, you see. And so that's what we have there. Once I saw that, I vowed that would never happen again and that I'd be a part of anything that was going on with Malcolm in the Capital Region.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with activist / organizer Brother X. This was part one of a 5-part series. To find the other parts, you can go to mediasanctuary.org. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice. It's produced for the community, by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. Teen dating violence starts as young as 10 years old. There are signs that parents should be aware of, benefits of having clear communication with your teen to avoid teen violence, and ways in which schools can help prevent teen dating violence. HMM's Eileen Javier speaks with Sarah McGaffney of Unity House about this issue.
Hi, my name is Eileen. February is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. And we're here today with Sarah McGaffney. She's the Program Director of Domestic Violence Services at Unity House. And she's going to talk with us about teen dating violence. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Eileen.
What does a teen dating violence relationship look like?
So teen dating violence looks similar to a domestic violence relationship that you would see in an adult, the pattern of behavior rooted in power and control. It looks different in a way that we're really looking at the age demographic, probably 10 through 24 are like, I'm going to say that's my youth age. That's my teenage of like young adults and teenagers, college age kids, and then school age kids, usually getting into unhealthy abusive relationships by 10 or 11. Huge abuse through technology. We've seen higher rates of abuse through technology in our LGBTQAI+ relationships, but just overall abuse through technology is huge. There are warning signs that you can see in your kids, right? Lack of interest. They're isolated. Do they have a broken cell phone, right? That's the number one thing that gets broken in an abusive relationship. The first thing an abusive partner will go to is a cell phone and smash it. And that's because that further isolates the victim. What I don't want you to do is realize, you know, maybe your child is in an abusive relationship and in an effort to help, take away the cell phone, take away social media. You can talk to your child about that and about safety, but you don't want to further isolate them. That's what gives into the perpetrator. And that's why oftentimes these teen victims, they feel like they're being punished, right? They're off social media. Oh my God, they can't talk to any of their friends. They don't have a cell phone. They're further isolated. So I encourage parents to have an open conversation and try to come up with the best plan they can to keep their child safe, but recognize the signs like, you know, lack of interest in activities, dressing differently, putting themselves down. That's a big one. So if someone is putting you down all day, like in a dating violence relationship, they're going to start projecting that and they're going to start putting themselves down, or often feeling like they have to check in with their partner about things that don't really make sense. You know, can you hang out with your friend on a Friday night? You shouldn't have to check in with your partner before you agree to that. And be aware of, like, I know it's like the classic teen relationship, like Romeo and Juliet, where they have to spend every moment together. But just being aware that there are times when your child is in a relationship, you know, when they're alone and they're alone with you, and kind of monitoring how much time they're spending together. Because abusive partners will spend every minute with a victim. They never want them to be without them. And if you think about it, that's just another way to isolate them, right? Because if they're never alone to ask for help, then they're always isolated. If they're always with a partner, they're never alone to ask for help. So looking for those things. And then the other thing, the big one is like unusual emotional responses to things, like being a little late for something, being a little late getting home, having your parents say, no, you can't go hang out with that person tonight, and just completely losing it, crying, anger, really just unusual emotional responses that don't fit the situation. Definitely withdrawing from friends, withdrawing from family activities. These are all big things you can look for. The other thing I really encourage parents to think about is, because we always put ourselves in the position of what if our child is the victim? But I really want to encourage parents to think about, what do you do if you believe your child is a perpetrator of violence? Because we can't ignore that. And your child may be hurting just as much. So we always want to help victims of violence. We want to make sure they're safe. But if you feel like your child is a perpetrator, it's important to talk to them same way, listen to them, find out why. But at the same time, take the power away. Because like I said, this is all about power and control. Take the power away. Let them know that you don't tolerate violence, that they're responsible and for anything they do, and there's no matter what the justification is, that they're responsible for their actions, and pressure them into taking accountability. So it's really, really important that we step in as parents for our children if they're being victimized, but also if they're perpetrating, because you want to stop it before it gets to a more severe level that they're getting in trouble. Another big thing I see with teens is like abuse masquerading as play. And where do they draw the line, right? So pretending to play fight, but it actually being physical abuse. I just think for all youth, I'd say like trust your instincts. If you don't feel comfortable and you ask your partner to stop and they won't stop, you need to, it's time to look for some help and some outside resources, because play fighting can turn really dangerous really quickly.
What are good ways for parents to intervene?
I believe it starts, you know, with the parents at home early as you can, with these open conversations about respect, about boundaries, about healthy boundaries. This gives you an opportunity, if you're having these conversations as often as possible, it gives you an opportunity if something happens to open the door for your child to tell you what's going on. And I urge you, I know as parents that we just want to make sure our kids are okay, and we want to help them in any way we can. But we have to be able to take a step back and realize that that doesn't always translate to a teenager in particular. Listen quietly, listen to the whole story. Let them tell you. Don't put their partner down, even though, you know, I know you don't want to see anyone hurting your child and you know that that person's abusive, but it's important you focus on your child and making sure that they're okay and listening to the whole story.
What do you think schools should do to support healthy teen relationships?
Absolutely. Schools have to help. Just as much as I said, parents have to help, schools have to help too. They're there for most of the day. Schools have to monitor that. They should be helping to provide prevention education. I believe prevention is key. We need to teach children how to have a healthy relationships, and prevention is so important, and teaching them how to have healthy relationships and supporting victims. Schools should be supporting victims, but at the same time, looking at perpetrators, and maybe it's not always about punishing them, because we don't want it to get to that level. We want to intervene early, support the victim, and look at what are you going to do for the perpetrator, right? You're going to talk to them. You want to find out what's going on, because there is no reason a 12-year-old should be in an abusive relationship or a 13-year-old should be in an abusive relationship. Maybe something is going on at home and you have to dig deeper and look to how you can support them, but also teaching them how to have a healthy relationship, teaching them conflict resolution, because what the answer could be is that they don't know. They saw this at home and they think this is how it's supposed to go. And they think this is what they're supposed to do. But teaching them how to have a healthy relationship. But the response I get from schools a lot is often that, and parents too, sometimes, is that, oh, they're teenagers, they're crazy. You know, we don't, like, not respecting really what they have to say and not hearing them because you think they're kids and they don't know what they're talking about. We really have to hear them and listen to them and support them through it.
Can you share information for teens where to get help if they find themselves in an abusive relationship or if they want to help a friend that might be abused?
Yeah. And I want to talk too about what if your friend is the abuser?
So, oh, that's so right.
Yes. So teens, they can all go to Unity House for help if they need help with anything. We can also help their friends. They can call us. Go to a parent. Go to a teacher you trust. And you can even, so the nice thing that I've done to partner with schools is I say, because schools have certain guidelines in place that I don't have in place, right? They have mandatory reportings that they have to go to parents and they have to go to certain people about. I don't have to do all that as a provider. I've told the school, like, call me in as like a middle of the ground person who's confidential, who's safe. I'll talk to the youth and we'll come up with a plan. And then we can all talk to the parent together. Then they don't feel like they're being penalized. Because what happens is the victim and the perpetrator, they're both going to feel like they're going to get in trouble. And we want them to feel supported, the victim to feel supported. We want the victim to feel like it's a safe place. So bringing in a third party who doesn't have any history on the situation and the victim doesn't feel like they have anything kind of against them or anything like that is really important. And I want kids to reach out to us, our hotline, our texting hotline, reach out for help. And I just want teens to know that there are things that we get this picture in our mind of how relationships are supposed to work. And we're really, really in deep on social media, right? And we see like this cute Instagram post of this perfect relationship, this perfect couple. And we don't realize that that's not always what's happening. And it's okay to ask for help. There's nothing wrong with you. Just getting help and or getting your friend help. Social, and for a friend who's a perpetrator, social pressure can go a long way. It is that easy for kids to say, why did you do that? That's not cool. And to stop an abusive behavior. And they could tell somebody about it. If they feel like they have to tell somebody about it, I want them to tell somebody about that. I encourage them to. But it's really easy for them to stop those early on with social pressure. If they think their friend is being abusive, calling their friend out on it and saying, that's not okay. Why would you do that? That's weird. Social pressure goes such a long way for kids. Helping their friends, they can reach out to the hotline. Same way they would help themselves. I want them to feel comfortable asking for help for their friends. To a teacher they trust, to a counselor they trust, they can ask their teacher or their counselors or anyone to call us, to call Unity House. I'll send a staff member out there to talk to them about their options, about what we can do, come up with a plan, because I can talk to them before I have to involve their parents and try to involve their parents on a common ground.
Mm-hmm. And what is the hotline?
The hotline is 518-272-2370. And I also want to give you the text line is 518-720-6161.
Sara, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
That was HMM's Eileen Javier speaking with Sarah McGaffney of Unity House. To reach Unity House's domestic violence hotline, you can call them at 518-272-2370. That's 518-272-2370. The COVID-19 pandemic has shuttered so many local businesses, but some have seized the moment to start new ventures. Collar City Mushrooms opened for business in the Lansingburg section of Troy on February 6th. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with owner, grower, and forager Avery Stemple about how he got into mushrooms, starting the business during the pandemic, plans for the future, what kinds of tasty mushrooms customers can buy at the shop, and what they can do with them.
Avery, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
When did you open Color City Mushrooms and where did the idea come from?
I grew up in the mountains of East Bern, New York, and I have always been fascinated with the outdoors. I love the outdoors, the naturalness of everything. And my grandfather opened a sawmill with the money that he earned being in the army during the Korean conflict. And he built his wife, my grandmother, and he a house using some logging equipment that he bought. And that grew into a family business. And so I was basically raised in the woods, going into various hills and mountains, exploring with my mom while my dad worked. I loved the splashes of color that you would find here and there tucked away. That grew into just a love and fascination of mushrooms from, you know, a very early age. When I met my girlfriend, Amy, about 5 years ago or so, she had been growing shiitake in logs on like a hobby level. I jumped right into that, and you know, we started expanding the shiitake collection. And then with the COVID crisis that hit last year, I had been managing the Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center at RPI. And unfortunately, performing arts were, you know, kind of canceled and still are for the foreseeable future. And I was furloughed. I decided at that point that it was time to dedicate what had been a hobby energy level activity to a full-time passion career. So June 1st, I registered Color City Mushrooms as an LLC and started looking for a building to open because I knew I wanted to start as an indoor urban mushroom farm. My long-term vision includes buying a forested plot somewhere nearby where we can, you know, build some mushroom-shaped yurts that people could camp in and, you know, take people on foraging walks during the week and teach them skills about foraging. And then ideally have some kind of large lodge space where we could bring what we foraged in the forest back and cook it immediately. So people are getting that direct experience of having something growing in the forest and bringing it to a kitchen and preparing it right there. And then incorporate that if, you know, people are staying for a few days or for a full week. Saturday nights, I would like to have a mushroom tea ceremony using ideally mushrooms that we've harvested from the forest around us, reishi or turkey tail, chaga, and having like a medicinal mushroom tea ceremony around a bonfire with some music. And then Sunday, people will go home with either a mushroom bag that they could grow their own mushrooms at home or some kind of oak log inoculated with shiitake or oysters, and then teach more of the cultivation process in that way.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Avery Stemple from Color City Mushrooms. How do you find the neighborhood of Lansingburg? It's really exciting to me. I myself live in Lansingburg. It's exciting that businesses are starting to pop up here in this area as opposed to concentrated in downtown Troy.
I actually like it a lot. I've lived in South Troy on Hill Street for 5 years now. And I really love Troy as a city. I've worked at RPI since 2008. I actually got my graduate degrees from Sage Colleges in the early aughts. And I've seen Troy develop now for 20 plus years. The growth that it's had really has been amazing. And it's a very supportive city. The businesses do like to interact and the people really love to support the things that are happening in the city. The buildings are really pretty. Like I love to imagine what Troy looked like at the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, because there was so much wealth in Troy and you can really see it in the architecture that's still existing. And some of these now multifamily houses, which were just single family houses, you know, originally. And especially this stretch of Second right on the river has such long expanses that I think could really lend to some better development and different businesses than, you know, what there is here where we are. I mean, as much as I love Napa, I love, you know, what is it, Advanced Auto or right up the street, but it's, we're in really a stretch of all auto businesses. It's right on the river and they're not utilizing the river at all. And one of the things that we plan to do is put in a dock and develop the riverbank a little bit and put in like a little labyrinth with some shrubs and some outdoor mushroom grow beds with like King Stropharia and some bluets. So people can sit on picnic tables actually right here by the river and then go down some stairs and go out onto the dock. And, you know, maybe we'll get some boat traffic, or if we're doing some dinner experience, we could actually have the people eat right out on the river, which I think would be just absolutely amazing. It's so pretty. It really deserves to be appreciated.
When did you open and what kind of business are you doing now?
Well, we moved into the building in October. We started building at the end of November and just got our certificate of occupancy a couple weeks ago. We opened on February 7th. That was our first day of actually allowing people to come in officially. I did not anticipate as much traffic as we had because I really haven't advertised that we're open or anything yet. But people have been driving by and seeing what we're doing, and I'm active on social media, and a lot of people have shared it on social media. And I mean, we sold out of the mushrooms that we were growing both Saturdays so far. Ideally, once we complete our construction and are growing to the capacity that we have right now, we're able to harvest 200 to 300 pounds of mushrooms a week and really get some wholesale clients, like, you know, restaurants and some CSAs, so that we can support the local food industry.
So for folks who want to visit your shop, what kind of mushrooms can they find to purchase there?
Oh, yeah, good question. I mean, right now, maitake is all harvested, so we won't have maitake again for quite a while. But we are growing blue oysters, pink oysters, white oysters, golden oysters. We are growing king trumpets and black king trumpets. Reishi, which is just a more of a medicinal one. It's not culinarily consumed typically. We're growing shiitake, lion's mane, beach mushrooms, and piapino mushrooms. We also just got some cordyceps strains, and we are going to be growing cordyceps, which are another medicinal mushroom.
This is so exciting for someone who loves to cook with mushrooms. All of those mushrooms combined together are just a delicious taste sensation in your mouth. Can you leave our listeners with a simple recipe that they can use from the mushrooms that they could get from your shop?
Sure. I mean, simple is just dice some of the mushrooms, and we actually start with a simmer. So a little bit of water, and let the water kind of cook out of the mushroom, because mushrooms are very heavy water concentration. And then you add your fat, whether you cook with butter or olive oil or some other kind of oil, and then salt and pepper, and you can kind of really get the taste of the mushroom in that way. As an example, for something a little bit more complicated, is we had two different mushrooms, beach mushrooms and maitake, that we cooked this morning with a little bit of ginger, garlic, and soy sauce. We added some steamed carrots and zucchini and sauteed that all together, and then served that over rice with a fried egg on top and some sriracha. And that was our breakfast this morning, and it was delicious.
Amazing. Where can our listeners find more information about when Color City Mushrooms is open and what kind of events you're holding there?
Well, you can follow us on Instagram at @color_city_mushrooms. We are on Facebook at Color City Mushrooms, and we also have a website, www.collarcitymushrooms.com.
Wonderful. I can't wait to see what you do next. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was HMM's Corinne Carey speaking with Avery Stemple, owner of Collar City Mushrooms. 257 organizations signed a letter to Congress with recommendations to address plastic pollution and environmental justice in petrochemical corridors. To close out the show, HMM's Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Casey Camp Horanek of the Ponca tribe, discussing environmental justice, ecocide, and why Congress must address pollution in the next stimulus bill. In this final part of their conversation, they discuss how the Ponca tribe has been impacted by coronavirus.
Thank you for your words, Casey. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind telling our listeners, we're here in New York on the land of the ancestral land of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican community, but wondering how your tribe is handling or has been affected by the coronavirus.
Well, first, I want to say thank you for the land acknowledgments. And this is, again, one more poke at the federal government. But many of us in the indigenous communities were really offended by the song, "This Land Is My Land, This Land Is Your Land," from California, et cetera, et cetera. A colonist song, if there ever was one, and there was no land acknowledgments. Those things that you just did are so valuable to us to intersect as human beings. We believe Black Lives Matter. We stand by our relatives there. We stand by all humans who have an interest in growth and interaction. But here in Ponca country, you know what, Alexis? I totally spaced your question.
It was, how have you been affected by the coronavirus?
Thank you again. We're suffering. We've lost. It's hard to even discuss. You know, we've lost many wisdom keepers, those that have those knowledges from the past that they've carried over into this time. We're a people of oral tradition, and our knowledges are passed down from grandmas and grandpas and great-grandmas and great-grandpas, aunties and uncles, to the generations on how to live, how to be in this world. And many have left us. Many of our children, that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren that we're used to being around all the time, have a full year away from us because they want to keep us safe. They're determined to do so. I know one family in the Oto Missouria tribe, that's our neighboring tribe here, where 22 members had that, because we lived in multi-generational families. We're all interconnected within our families. As I said, we were reduced to 200. Now we're up to 3,000. But there are many of us that are just family and clan and people that are having a hard time. But I want to also mention that we've had people within our Indian healthcare system. It bothers me on every level to say that, because we're not Indian. We're individual nations of indigenous peoples of this portion of Turtle Island, of this red quadrant of the Mother Earth. But our health services, while have been inadequate in so many ways, it's like you're not treated holistically. It's like going to the emergency room and you have something broken or messed up, that at that emergency room, they don't look at your history and treat you that way. That's very much like our health system. And poor things are, the amount of money for our health care has been cut, because we're disposable. They've always tried to kill us. And so when COVID came along, many of our health care workers, frontline workers, just jumped into going and doing as fast as they can. And as a result, many of us are vaccinated now before even our neighbors are. And so then our healthcare system is reaching out into our neighbors and helping the non-Indigenous people as well. So we're devastated. On one hand, we are losing people left and right. So many, I can't even count them because of the comorbidities of our bodies. On the other hand, we're moving into an area where I'm feeling confident by this end of this spring, we'll be with our grandchildren and great-grandchildren again. And thank you for asking.
I'm so sorry to hear about the losses that you've had.
May I also?
I'm crying a little bit.
Alexis, it's so painful. It's hard to talk about, and I appreciate your feelings as well. Because part of the loss of our people is we also can't practice our traditional ways of. We sit with our people after they're made transition for 4 days. We eat together for those 4 days. We talk about the stories. We connect with our families, and our babies are there with us. We can't do that right now either, you know, because of COVID. So the effects are more than I'm even able to tell you. And for you to feel that way means a great deal. Thank you, Alexis.
Well, I'm off the record. No, I won't go into that story. But I really appreciate you having the strength to share your story with us, Casey, here in New York. Again, on the ancestral lands of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation. We're out of time, but is there anything else that you'd like to add before we sign off?
I want every person that is listening to put on your warrior moccasins and to do something today.
That was HMM's Alexis Goldsmith speaking with Casey Camp Horonek of the Ponca tribe. To hear the full interview on our website, go to mediasanctuary.org. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Sina Basila Hickey. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WOOC105.3FM. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390. That's 518-272-2390. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.